dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. This week, we continue with the reading of The Ascent of Humanity by Charles Eisenstein. Continuing in Chapter 6, The Crumbling of Certainty, Eisenstein wrote, "One of the goals of this chapter is to translate animism into the language of modern science." Earlier in the chapter, he explained how new thinking in physics and mathematics has demonstrated that the nature of reality cannot be understood by reducing it to its parts, because it misses a significant section of reality, those things which are properties that emerge from interrelationships, from the whole. This week, Eisenstein will examine some of the current ideas in biology that demonstrate that the natural world is fundamentally cooperative, and that the idea of an individual organism competing with others for supremacy is more dogma than fact, a product of the worldview of the separate self and the ideology of domination and control. The reading this week begins as Eisenstein critiques intelligent design not from the usual position of neo-Darwinism, but from a third alternative, the perspective of complexity theory that posits that order emerges naturally from systems that become sufficiently complex, that cooperation, not competition, is the basis of life on Earth. So we continue with The Ascent of Humanity by Charles Eisenstein, published in 2006. For a long time, we've seen their external supernatural God as the only alternative to an indifferent, mechanical, purposeless universe. No longer, the spontaneous emergence of organization in mathematical, chemical, and biological systems offers a third alternative. What if the coordination, purpose, and beauty we observe are inseparable properties of matter? What if divinity is an organic property of reality? So steeped are we in a dualistic mindset that we can hardly conceive of a purpose to nature except as externally defined by a supernatural intentional force, namely God. External to matter, such a God is by definition outside the subject area of science. Remember, though, that the whole conception of God as a force above and apart from nature is surely only as old as agriculture, reflecting the other dualistic separations that gained momentum in that time. Yet human intuitions of a meaning or significance to life surely predate agriculture with its supernal God, indicating that an external imposer of meaning, an external designer of purpose, is necessary only to the dualistic mind. The fundamentalist movement, along with most of the New Age, as well as transplanted spirituality from the East, is in part a response to the loss of sacredness that science seems to imply, and in part a reaction to the moral and social fragmentation that shares a common root with science in the age of separation. Agreeing with science that the ordinary world of matter is devoid of sacredness, They imagine a spiritual realm apart from the world, or in the case of Eastern transplants, retreat inward to the depths of the mind, ritual, yoga, and other spiritual practice. Religion thereby abets the mechanistic assumption of science. The world of matter is just matter, seen in this light, the doctrine of intelligent design, intended to bring God back into science, actually ends up confirming the soullessness of the physical world, the world of life and human life. Scientists typically cringe at any mention of an intention or purpose to evolution. Tenaciously defending the Darwinian dogma that evolution arises solely from random variation and selection based on survival and replication. Alternative theories of biogenesis and evolution subvert deep-seated cultural assumptions of self and world, thus offending our intuitions. On a more superficial level, scientists' antipathy toward dissenting theories stems from their common association with the anti-scientific attacks of various proponents of creationism. Therefore, before I draw out the cultural and spiritual implications of some alternatives to Darwinism, I want to make clear right now, doubtless eliciting a sigh of relief from the scientific reader, that I am not going to espouse any form of creationism or intelligent design, ID, in this book. I sympathize with the motivation of the proponents of ID and creationism, however, and my sympathy is not of the patronizing variety which imputes to them a childish refusal to accept the obvious facts of the universe. No, their ultimate motivation is a sincere protest against a world that has been shorn of sacredness and purpose. They intuit that sacredness and purpose are real properties of the universe, and not human projections, not the superstitious, wishful thinking of people unable to cope with a universe that, to quote Richard Dawkins again, has precisely the properties we should expect if there is at bottom no design, no purpose, no evil, and no good, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. Unfortunately, the proponents of ID are themselves subject to most of the same deeper, hidden assumptions about the nature of reality that grip the scientific mainstream. This is no wonder, for these assumptions are written into the very culture we live in, into the conceptual vocabulary we use to describe the world, into the very structure of modern thought and language. The proponents of intelligent design are unwittingly replacing a greater miracle with a lesser miracle, a greater God with a lesser God, and a greater mystery with a lesser mystery. They are also again unwittingly contributing to the very desacralization of the universe that is so unsettling about the scientific cosmology that dominates today. Their opposition to the atheistic cosmology, genesis, and evolution that is today's orthodoxy is actually a superficial opposition. On a deeper level, proponents of intelligent design exacerbate the very dualism that has robbed the modern world of sacredness and meaning. The typical ID argument first cites some of the well-known and very real difficulties of the neo-Darwinian orthodoxy. Then, citing the wild improbability of sophisticated structures such as the eye or the cellular metabolism having developed by chance, it goes on to conclude that such structures must therefore have been planned out and guided by a superhuman intelligence. Something as complex, as tightly coordinated, as miraculous as a living being could never have emerged spontaneously. Therefore, it must have been consciously designed. But the very concept of design already smuggles in Newtonian concepts of reductionism, dualism, and mechanism. How do we go about designing something? Through a reductionistic process of assembling components, each of which themselves may also require designing. Design is hierarchical and modular. A problem is broken up into manageable pieces arranged by an outside intelligence. Spontaneous processes of growth are not considered design. Organisms do not design themselves, nor do parents design their children. Trapped in a dualistic mindset, we're hard-pressed indeed to see how complex, highly ordered, tightly coupled systems could have come about by themselves without external guidance. Our logic tells us that if it's purposeful, it must have been designed with a purpose. We cannot conceive of a purpose without a purposer, a design without a designer, beauty without an artist. Because that has been our relationship to the world ever since agriculture supplanted the spontaneous goodness of nature with the imposed goodness of cultivation. In the mindset of agriculture, goodness comes forth only with work. Else the field runs to weeds and the livestock goes feral. The logic that inspires intelligent design is also the logic of engineering and control. It is the logic that defines the technological program whose failure is increasingly evident. To me, it is a far greater miracle that reality has the property of self-organization. Why should it? Why should reality not be boringly linear instead? Intelligent design carries a deep hidden assumption that the universe is not inherently beautiful, alive, inspirited, but that it had to be made that way by an outside deity. The universe is just dead matter until God makes something of it. Life could only have sprung from the primordial soup if God had made it happen. The cell, the organism, the organ, the ecosystem could not work so perfectly by themselves. Matter has not that property. Intelligent design posits a universe that is less spiritual and not more. The mother of all religions, animism, had no such dualism in it. Animism, often misunderstood as the belief that all things are possessed of spirit, actually holds that all things are spirit. It holds that all things are sacred in themselves, and not conditionally sacred because of something they may, and by implication may not, possess. One of the goals of this chapter is to translate animism into the language of modern science. I reject intelligent design more out of a religious sentiment than a scientific sentiment. For the wonder, the magic, the ongoing miracle of a living universe pregnant with creativity, order, and beauty is far more stupendous than a conditional creation contingent on a separate creator God. The quasi-religious awe a biologist feels upon truly appreciating the complexity of a living cell is diminished, not enhanced, by the explanation. It's like that because God made it that way, just as it also is diminished by the conventional explanation that it arose through a purposeless concatenation of improbable events. The spontaneous arising of order, beauty, and life that is written into the laws of the universe, and even more deeply into the structure of mathematics, that is repeated in every nonlinear system with certain very general characteristics, and that is like that only because it is like that and could be no other way, is far more awesome. I offer the reader not a mundane universe in which nothing is sacred because there is no God, nor a split universe in which some things are wholly of God and others just matter, but rather a universe that is fully sacred, pregnant with meaning, immanent with divinity, in which order, organization, and beauty arise spontaneously from the ground up, neither imposed from above by a designer, nor projected from within by the observer, and of which God is an inseparable property. The marvelous complexity and beauty of nature is not some consolation prize for science's denial of the sacred, but evidence that the universe itself is sacred. The awe of the cell biologist is not quasi-religious, it is religious. Note the obstacle of language apparent in the above discussion. By using words like sacred and spiritual, I draw on meanings that imply a divided universe containing the non-spiritual and the profane. Dualism is built into our language and thought. What could spiritual or sacred mean in the absence of a separate realm? For me, as for the animist, it means that every living being, every process of nature, every bit of matter is a unique individual that is nonetheless not separate from myself. Not even electrons are generic identical particles. Each is unique, and its behavior forever irreducible to causes. There are no its in the universe, only yous or thous, each utterly unique. And yet I and thou are one. It is impossible to put this into words without generating a paradox. Impossible? Why? It is in the nature of words as labels, representations, symbols to categorize, abstract, and divide the world. So don't rely on words to understand how each thou is unique, and yet I and thou are one. Look into a lover's eyes instead, or let the birds sing it to you. Each electron, each drop of water, each pebble, each everything is therefore qualified to receive our love. We cannot love the standard and generic, except in the abstract. Love is personal. It sees you as unique and fully you, and it knows a connection so profound as to blur your distinctions from me. The purpose possessed by all beings in the universe, and indeed by the universe itself, is an aspect of this uniqueness, this sacredness of all being. The experience of it suffuses our lives with love, awe, and respect. Perhaps the import of the gathering paradigm shift is now becoming clearer. It marks the end of the age of separation and the beginning of a new age that I call the age of reunion. It marks the end of civilization as we know it and the birth of a new kind of civilization. The civilization we have known has always been built upon the escalating domestication of nature. The ascent of humanity has always been a project of imposing human purpose and human design onto the raw materials of an inert reality. That has been the grand project of civilization, to bring order to chaos. And now we are discovering that order arises naturally from chaos anyway, and chaos from order. And from that chaos, new order of even higher degree, an ascending spiral of yin and yang. The age of the frontiersman conquering nature and bringing it to order is over, as we turn towards seeking the right role for human consciousness in the continued unfolding of order in the universe. The new human relationship to the world will be that of a lover to his or her beloved. For thousands of years, the relationship has been one of control based on fear. Our technology, the concrete manifestation of that relationship, is therefore mostly a technology of fear as well. Can we even imagine what a technology of love would look like? One thing is certain, the devotional relationship of which I speak does not mean the diminishment or fading of the human race or a return to the Stone Age. In his devotion to the beloved, the lover grows himself. Love is not a sacrifice, it is a mutual fulfillment. Love itself denies the logic of the separate self. A universe that is inherently creative or inherently purposeful has no need of intelligent design, nor of unlikely chains of coincidences, and has broad implications for our individual lives as well as the collective function and destiny of the human species. This will become apparent in the second half of this chapter, as we come back to Earth to examine some elements of the neo-Lamarckian paradigms that are gradually creeping into biology. Growing evidence that mutation is not in fact random calls into question the very cogency of the selfish gene theory of biogenesis, evolution, and behavior. in place of this competition-based worldview, a new paradigm is emerging that emphasizes symbiosis, cooperation, and the sharing of DNA across species boundaries, calling the integrity of the discrete biological self further into doubt. In its place, a new concept of self arises, defined through its relationships and constitutionally impervious to the program of reduction and control. Remember, the entire edifice of civilization arises from our sense of self as discrete and separate. Now we are building the foundation of a new sense of self, and therefore of a new kind of technology, a new kind of money, a new kind of civilization. What will a technology of love look like in the age of reunion? Nature provides a clue. And I'm reading from Chapter 6, The Crumbling of Certainty, from The Ascent of Humanity by Charles Eisenstein, published in 2006. Continuing with the next section, The Purpose of Nature. The neo-Darwinian account of the evolution of life rests on two key pillars, each of which is deeply woven into our worldview: random mutation and natural selection. Randomness is the opposite of purposiveness, and a necessary adjunct to a world of standard generic building blocks. Natural selection is the projection onto biology of the ambient anxiety and competitiveness of our culture. These associations ensure that neo-Darwinism will be orthodoxy in the age of separation. But what exactly do random mutation and natural selection act on? What is the biological self that suffers mutation and that competes for survival against other selves? A coherent answer to this question is crucial to the coherency of the entire neo-Darwinian paradigm. If we find instead yet another projection of our culturally constructed conception of self, then the entire edifice of neo-Darwinism is a projection as well. The standard answer is that the subject of natural selection is the gene, biology's version of the discrete and separate self. Through their manipulations of the environment, via the organisms they code for, command, and control, genes enact the struggle for survival that drives evolution. By necessity, their primary relationship to each other is competitive. They are here because over the eons, they out-survived and out-replicated all their competitors. Genes have no desire to evolve, but sometimes they mutate by chance into new genes that are even better at survival and replication. In this way, without any intention or purpose or program, the genes evolve. The only direction to evolution is toward genes that are better and better at surviving and replicating. To the extent that the word purpose has any meaning at all, this is the gene's sole purpose. As for organisms, such as you and I, that the genes code for, these are merely the instruments by which genes survive and reproduce. Insulated like the Cartesian soul from the environment, the interests of the genes are only coincidentally aligned with the interests of the organism. The struggles, desires, and adaptations of the organism do not affect the genes, nor do the needs of other organisms. The relationship between genes and environment is one way. The genes alter the environment through the organisms they program. But the only effect the environment has on the genes is either to prevent them from being passed on or to randomly alter them through mutation. The gene is the master, the organism the servant. The environment is a reservoir of resources and a source of threats. In parallel, we see humankind as the master, technology as the servant, and the environment again as a reservoir of resources and a source of threats. On the individual level, economics and other transactional models of human behavior utilize a structurally equivalent scheme. Life is about me, what I can get, and how I can get it. The integrity of the neo-Darwinian worldview depends on all the elements described above. Remove one and the whole fabric unravels. Along with it goes a whole constellation of intuitions about the nature of self and the way of the world. Today, indeed, the entire fabric of neo-Darwinism is unraveling, contributing to and impelled by the unraveling of the larger paradigms of the world and self that embed it. We could start with any of neo-Darwinism's frayed threads, and it will lead us to all the others. So let us start with the core of the biological definition of self, the genes. Contrary to the prevailing dogma, the genes are not in fact the command and control center for the cell, nor do they stand in isolation from the non-random and hence, in some sense, purposeful effects of the environment. In his 1990 paper, Metaphors and the Roles of Genes and Development, the eminent biologist N. H. Njut argues that two central metaphors of biology, that genes control development and that genes embody programs for development, are highly misleading. He writes, quote, "The simplest and also the only strictly correct view of the function of genes is that they supply cells and ultimately organisms and ultimately the environment with chemical materials," close quote. And, quote, "When a gene product is needed, a signal from its environment, not an emergent property of the gene itself, activates the expression of that gene," close quote. If the gene is the biological self, it has few of the attributes of Cartesian selfhood. These are projections. The gene is not the control center, not the brain of the cell. In fact, enucleated cells can survive for months without any impairment of their ability to move, digest food, excrete wastes, exchange gases, communicate with other cells, and otherwise respond to their environment, all without genes. Only when their protein parts begin to wear out do these cells' functions begin to deteriorate. Applying the gene metaphorically as an analog to the self, we exist to contribute our gifts to the larger wholes of which we are a part. Something in our environment calls upon us, activates expression of the gene, and we provide our unique gift that in turn activates the contribution of another. It's not about maximizing self-interest at all. The microbiologist Bruce Lipton offers a conceptual model of the cell that makes the role of genes clear. The brain of the cell, he says, is not the nucleus, but actually the cell membrane, which senses the extracellular environment via its receptor proteins and then via effector proteins, translates this data into instructions for the interior of the cell, including the DNA, to carry out. This, he observes, is on a schematic level exactly what a brain does. The genes cannot turn themselves on and off. It is the cell membrane with its chemical messengers that does that. The nucleus and the ribosomes are merely the manufacturing facility and not the headquarters, the hard disk and not the CPU. It is in fact the cell membranes, the mediator for the environment, from whence the instructions actually originate. So in contrast to a lordly self, manipulating an external not-self from its headquarters, we have a two-way interaction in which environment defines self just as much as self molds environment, blurring the distinction between the two. No longer does biology lend itself as a metaphoric model for some Cartesian seat of the soul, center of awareness and free will, looking out upon a mechanistic world of dead matter. Further eroding the self-other distinction is the fact that not only does the environment turn DNA on and off, it can even change DNA in a non-random way. cells and organisms, and through them, other life forms and the environment as a whole, can modify their own DNA to produce necessary traits. What's more, these modifications can affect germline cells so that the associated acquired traits can be inherited. Hold on! Haven't I just asserted Lamarckism, the thoroughly discredited theory of inheritance of acquired characteristics proposed by Jean-Baptiste Lamarck in 1806? Lamarckism, of whose founder George Bernard Shaw wrote in 1921, poor Lamarck was swept aside as a crude and exploded guesser, hardly worthy to be named as Darwin's erroneous forerunner. Close quote. Despite 200 years of unremitting ridicule, Lamarck's basic idea is receiving increasing vindication. Much more than the mere mechanism of evolution is at stake, because Lamarck's theory was not so simplistic as the usual derided example of each generation of giraffes stretched their necks to reach higher leaves, and the longer necks were passed on to the next generation. The crux of his thinking is laid out in the following, quote, "It is not the shape, either of the body or its parts, which gives rise to the habits of animals and their mode of life, but that it is, on the contrary, the habits and mode of life and all the other influences of the environment which have in the course of time built up the shape of the body and the parts of animals. With new shapes, new faculties have been acquired, and little by little nature has succeeded in fashioning animals as we actually see them." Close quote. Of course, we must interpret Lamarck's theory through our knowledge of the genetic basis of inheritance and morphology. To make the theory work, the acquired characteristics must arise from changes in the genes that can be passed on. Lamarckism, in its modern form, simply states that these changes can be acquired in the course of a lifetime through purposeful adaptation. Neo-Darwinism, on the other hand, says they arise only from random mutation. Thus, the experiment that purported to disprove Lamarckism once and for all is not really a test of Lamarckism at all. Weissmann's experiment with mice, in which he cut off the tails of each generation and found that the next generation was always born with tails of normal length, demolishes at best a reduced and distorted caricature of Lamarckism. If acquired characteristics may be inherited, the door is open for this inheritance to reflect purpose, both of the organism and the environment. Shaw interprets Lamarck along these lines, quote, "How did he come by his long neck? Lamarck would have said, by wanting to get at the tender leaves high up on the tree, and trying until he succeeded in wishing the necessary length of neck into existence." Evolution happens, in other words, through wanting, through intention. Shaw goes on to write, quote, "Another answer is also possibly, namely that some prehistoric stock breeder, wishing to produce a natural curiosity, selected the longest-necked animals he could find and bred from them until at last an animal with an abnormally long neck was evolved by intentional selection, just as the racehorse or the fantail pigeon has been evolved. Both these explanations, you will observe, involve consciousness, will, design, purpose, either on the part of the animal itself or on the part of a superior intelligence controlling its destiny. Darwin pointed out, and this and no more was Darwin's famous discovery, that a third explanation involving neither will nor purpose nor design, either in the animal or anyone else, was on the cards. If your neck is too short to reach your food, you die. That may be the simple explanation of the fact that all surviving animals that feed on foliage have necks or trunks long enough to reach it. So bang goes your belief that the necks must have been designed to reach the food. But Lamarck did not believe that the necks were so designed in the beginning. He believed that the long necks were evolved by wanting and trying. Not necessarily, said Darwin. Suppose the average height of the foliage-eating animals is 4 feet, and that they increase in numbers until a time comes when all the trees are eaten away within 4 feet of the ground. Then the animals who happen to be an inch or two short of the average will die of starvation. All the animals who happen to be an inch or so above the average will be better fed and stronger than the others. And this, mark you, without the intervention of any stock breeder, human or divine, and without will, purpose, design, or even consciousness beyond the blind will to satisfy hunger. It is true that this blind will, being in effect a will to live, gives away the whole case, but still, as compared to the open-eyed, intelligent, wanting, and trying of Lamarck, the Darwinian process may be described as a chapter of accidents. As such, it seems simple, because you do not at first realize all that it involves, but when its whole significance dawns on you, your heart sinks into a heap of sand within you. There is a hideous fatalism about it. A ghastly and damnable reduction of beauty and intelligence, of strength and purpose, of honor and aspiration. To call this natural selection is a blasphemy, possible to many for whom nature is nothing but a casual aggregation of inert and dead matter. Close quote. Ironically enough, it is now neo-Lamarckism that offers a third explanation besides intelligent design and random choice. Consciousness, will, design, purpose can guide evolution even without an external designer or purposer. And just to make the full extent of the heresy plain, let me emphasize that it is not just organisms or cells that modify their own DNA. The blurring of self and other goes further than that. The extrasomatic environment also participates in the modification of genes, so that they serve the purposes not only of the organism, but of the community, the ecosystem and the planet, maybe even of the cosmos. In other words, it's not just that the giraffe wants to reach the higher leaves, or that proto-humans wanted hands that could grasp tools. An empty niche in the environment exerts an evolutionary pull. An unfolding pattern draws creatures to occupy the necessary roles. That is to say, the world wanted it too. Speaking metaphorically, our gifts and potentials are called forth by life's opportunities and by the world's needs. They are not independently pre-existent to be imposed by force upon an unconscious universe. Evolution, whether of the soul or of the species, unfolds in coordination with the evolution of all. Lamarckism stands as a term of disparagement because its doctrine is inescapably teleological. That heritable change is more than a haphazard triage of randomly generated possibilities is problematic to our culture's program of control, for it undermines the ideology that leaves us the lords and possessors of nature. While in Darwin's scheme the ultimate purpose of life is to survive, Lamarck's admits a higher sort of purpose associated with will or intention. And if nature's forms and systems express a purpose, then we must doubt our absolute suzerainty over nature. We must doubt the assumption that we can engineer nature endlessly with impunity, especially when we do so in ignorance of its purposes. In a blind, purposeless universe, we are at perfect liberty to do our will, for there is no natural order on which we might infringe, no destiny to interfere in, no destiny at all, in fact, except that which we create. But if there is a purpose inherent in the way of the world, then the whole bent of science must change from understanding for control's sake to understanding for the sake of according more closely to nature's purpose. Asking of ourselves, what are we for? We will seek out our proper role and function on the planet and in the universe. This transition, which I believe will inevitably flow from the new scientific paradigms described herein, represents our abdication from the pretense to lordship over nature to become nature's humble student. Observing nature through our cultural lenses of separation, competition, and survival anxiety, we have long been blind to the fact that nature doesn't always work that way. Nonetheless, evidence for the non-randomness of genetic change is mounting. It is now widely accepted that the rates of genetic mutation increase when organisms are under stress, presumably to increase the likelihood of a mutation that will arise that is better adapted to the stressor. Reflecting consensus, a recent article in Nature opines, quote, "It makes sense for stress responses to cause mutations. It may be a selected feature that increases genetic variation, thus increasing evolvability under stress when organisms are suboptimally adapted to their environments. Most of the mutations would be harmful or neutral, but rare adaptive mutations would also occur." Close quote. Recent research implies that this stress can be the quite common occurrence of running low on food, implying that accelerated mutation is an ordinary feature of bacterial life. Even though such mutations are thought to still be random, stress-induced mutagenesis is immensely problematic to the standard selfish gene theory. The unit of selection is supposed to be the gene, not the organism. Genetic characteristics, such as mutability, that benefit the organism in a way that does not promote the gene's replication in future generations, would be selected against. More controversial by far is a concept sometimes called adaptive mutation that has cropped up intermittently in biology under various guises ever since the days of Jean-Baptiste Lamarck. Reintroduced in 1988 by John Cairns, it claims that mutations are not fully random, but are somehow biased toward an adaptive purpose. Cairns disabled a gene in E. coli that produces an enzyme to digest lactose, then put the E. coli in a lactose-only medium. To his surprise, the disabled gene mutated back to the original enzyme-producing version, not in every bacteria, but at a higher rate than in a control culture where the bacteria had food sources other than lactose. While the consensus is that an overall elevated but still random stress-induced mutation rate can explain this finding, other research supports the idea that it may be truly adaptive. B.G. Hall found that a similar E. coli mutation happened to permit utilization of the sugar arbutin in the presence of starvation, but only when there was arbutin in the medium. The mutation happened at a much higher rate, specifically when it was useful. Other research has found that increased mutation rates under stress are not evenly distributed across the genome, but are much higher in precisely those areas which may generate beneficial mutations. The controversy rages on today, with orthodox opinion maintaining that stress-induced hypermutability can fully explain adaptive mutation and thus preserve Darwinianism. There are several reasons for the mainstream aversion to true adaptive mutation. Some commentators seem to feel it would entail spooky foreknowledge of what mutations would be useful. Personally, I am a fan of spooky foreknowledge, but in the case of adaptive mutation, it is unnecessary. All that is needed is a way for the DNA to sense and internalize signals from the environment. In other words, a way for the environment to speak to the DNA, to alter it purposefully, just as the DNA, mediated by the organism, alters the environment. Adaptive mutation implies a tight coupling between gene and environment that calls into question the very definition of the biological self. To say that the gene responds to the environment is a conceit, just as easily we could say that the environment molds the gene. The precise mechanisms by which this happens are unknown and mostly unexplored, due to the widespread belief that nature doesn't work that way. Nonetheless, there are several confirmed examples already, along with some interesting speculation. Mainstream biology has long accepted that reverse transcriptase allows RNA to rewrite DNA, and that antibodies in immune cells help to modify the DNA that produces them. More radical, but also now widely accepted, is the observation that epigenetic proteins, which envelop the DNA double helix, also carry heritable information that affects the way genes are expressed. What's more, these epigenetic proteins are also subject to heritable environmental modification. More radical still are proposals that invoke electromagnetic or other vibrational induction of genetic change. Finally, I must mention John Joe McFadden's very clever effort to bring spooky foreknowledge back into evolution through the quantum Zeno effect. His full argument is beyond the scope of the present chapter, but essentially he believes that genes take advantage of quantum superpositions of states to scan the search of space of possible mutations whose viability is confirmed by the observer effect of their own progeny. Whatever the mechanism, evidence is mounting that the environment influences genes through mechanisms beyond mere natural selection. The evidence has been mounting, in fact, for a long time, as Charles Darwin, himself remarkably free of the dogma of Darwinism, acknowledged in 1888. Quote, "In my opinion, the greatest error which I have committed has not been allowing sufficient weight to the direct action of the environments, food, climate, etc., independently of natural selection. When I wrote The Origin, and for some years afterwards, I could find little good evidence of the direct action of the environment. Now there is a large body of evidence." Close quote. If Darwin was aware of it in 1888, why do most biologists still ignore this good evidence today? Indeed, the evidence today is far greater. The institutional insistence on the primacy of the DNA as the controller program for morphology and behavior, and on the randomness of its evolution that is driven solely by natural selection, derives not from the evidence, but from deeper cultural assumptions about who we are. The challenge that adaptive mutation presents strikes at the heart of our culture's dualistic conception of world and self. Purpose, once the sole province of the conscious self of psychology, or at least the sentient self of biology, escapes the confines of individual actors, purposers, to become a property of the world as a whole. No longer do the genes necessarily act in their own self-interest, nor even, as we shall see, the selfish interest of the organism they are part of. Rather than being the source of purpose, which is only to survive, they are a means by which organism and environment enact purpose. In that case, in what sense are the genes the kernel of biological selfhood? Yes, they carry heritable instructions for building bodies, but it is outside signals that activate them. Nor are these instructions inviolable. They are readily modified according to need. Wouldn't that which modifies them be a more appropriate choice for selfhood? Our Cartesian intuitions tell us that ultimate authority must reside somewhere, but the invoker or modifier is not a discrete entity either. It is the cell, the organism, even the environment. The self is no longer so rigidly defined. Therefore, neither is self-interest. Who are we? The question has no definite answer. Different answers are expedient for different purposes, but none is complete. Natural selection depends for its primacy on a discrete self to act on, but we are now learning that the self of biology, the subject of natural selection, is not discrete but fluid, merging by degrees into the genetic plenum. Direct evidence for adaptive mutation is still ambiguous. However, if natural selection on random mutations of replicating DNA is not the prime mover of evolution, then we must construct a coherent understanding of life, its origins, and its evolution that does not rely on competition among discrete genetic subjects. Fortunately, just such a story is emerging today and gradually infiltrating mainstream biology. It is a story in which cooperation, just as much as competition, defines relationships among living beings, in which symbiosis and merger across fluid genetic boundaries drive evolution, and in which purpose arises from both within the organism and without. No longer is biology a study of separate and competing cells, and no longer will that idea inform our intuitions about the way of the world. And I'm reading from The Ascent of Humanity by Charles Eisenstein. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. Life without a replicator. A creation myth can be a powerful window into a culture's most important belief system. In Chapter 3, I described the creation myth of biology, the conventionally accepted story of how life originated with an initial replicating molecule, which eventually mutated and evolved into the diversity of forms we see today. Lost amid all the speculation about possible RNA or peptide candidates for the first replicating molecule is the fact that no such molecule exists today. There is no gene, no sequence of DNA or RNA that can replicate itself, not without an awful lot of help from other genes. In fact, what genetic reproduction entails is many, many genes cooperating in their mutual replication. Each gene plays a very limited, though sometimes indispensable, role in this collective replication. Perhaps it provides instructions for the production of a protein important in sex hormone production. Perhaps it turns on another gene that initiates cell differentiation at a crucial stage of development. Each of these and other functions certainly are necessary for a gene's replication, but they are not sufficient. Even in the simplest organism, even in a virus, no gene can autonomously replicate itself. In mitotic cell division, a diversity of enzymes and signaling proteins contribute indispensably to the whole process, each coded for by a different gene and each useless by itself. Helicase, polymerase, cyclin, and CDK are each produced from a distinct gene, and if even one is missing, mitosis fails utterly. Genes do not replicate themselves. At its most fundamental level, reproduction and survival is a cooperative effort. Why, then, is biogenetic theory overwhelmingly focused on explaining the origin of the first replicator? Why do we look for this mythical molecule capable of self-replication when life does not work that way? In Chapter 3, I describe the cultural biases that motivate and reinforce the selfish gene conception of life, a world of clearly demarcated competing selves, in which cooperation is incidental and not a necessary or fundamental feature of life, is consistent with the philosophies of the scientific revolution and our self-imposed separation from nature and each other. We find it as well in our systems of money, education, medicine, law, and religion. Projecting our own culture onto life, we see it as red in tooth and claw, driven from the outset by a ruthlessly selfish competition to survive. And the subject of this selfishness is the gene, the replicator. Because it is an elegant and parsimonious theory, and because it fits so well with our culture's conception of self and world, the neo-Darwinian synthesis has persisted as the dominant paradigm for a long time, despite several formidable problems that have never been resolved. Chief among these is the survivability of intermediates and the closely related problem of irreducible complexity, IC. At each level of organization, standard evolutionary theory runs up against enormous leaps in complexity that are difficult to reconcile with undirected random mutation. And the solution points toward not only a different conception of the self that is relationally defined, but also a different understanding of the relative importance of cooperation and competition, a different conception of the nature of life that is not nasty, brutish, and short, a different attitude toward the program of control, and a vastly different understanding of progress, human society, and human relationship. The first such leap of complexity that evolutionary theory must contend with is, of course, the origin of life. The original version of the problem was the chicken and the egg situation, in which DNA requires proteins to catalyze its replication, while proteins can only be produced by DNA. Which came first? A possible solution came with the discovery in 1982 of ribozymes, RNA molecules that can perform both catalytic and information storage functions, implying the possibility of an RNA world without the need for proteins. However, this solution pushes the chicken and egg problem into another realm, as the next paragraph describes. You can skip it if you want, but we won't. Despite these enormous difficulties, research on the RNA world remains, in the world of one commentator, a medium-sized industry unto itself. Motivating this effort is the conviction that there must have been a first replicator somehow, because our entire conception of what life is, what the self is, and how the universe works is dependent on it. It is the original, discrete, and separate self. RNA world theories are full of all kinds of highly contrived, ad hoc preconditions, based on the assumption that something like this had to have happened. First, there is the problem of getting an initial prebiotic soup full of BD ribonucleotides, about which two leading researchers, Joyce and Orgel, write, quote, "We conclude that the direct synthesis of nucleosides or nucleotides from prebiotic precursors in reasonable yields and unaccompanied by larger amounts of related molecules could not be achieved by presently known chemical reactions." Quote, "Worse yet, even if such synthesis were achieved, there is no plausible mechanism to resolve the left-handed L-isomers from the right-handed D-isomers, which is necessary because the presence of the L-version, which does not exist in biology, inhibits the polymerization of the D-version. A further problem is the synthesis of polynucleotides with the correct 3-5 linkages, which would be in the minority in the absence of some specific catalyst. Thirdly, even if some pre-replication polymerization mechanism existed, there is the difficulty of traversing the enormous search space of possible polynucleotides for one that engages in self-replication, yet without the evolutionary search mechanisms of error-prone replication, another chicken-and-egg problem.